Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, Managing Director of Mill Creek Financial Partners.
Hello, Mill Creek View podcast listeners. I have another great show for you today. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, make sure to visit us at Spotify or iHeartRadio or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. Why? So you won't miss a single episode like today's. And thank you. It really helps. Welcome to our People in the News segment, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. This week, we are talking with Tennessee State Representative John Reagan of Oak Ridge. Yes, where the Oak Ridge boys are from, and founded in the 1940s. Wow, cool. Representative Reagan, thank you so much. I just want to give a little intro here. Is the chairman of Government Operations Committee, grew up with a great love for our country. He knew early on that he wanted to serve our families and our communities. John went on to the United States Air Force Academy, but his love of our country and love of knowledge didn't stop there. John received a master's from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, attending the University of Tennessee, big win this weekend, as a postgraduate student, and attended the University of Oklahoma, the University of Southern California, just like me, and the University of North Carolina in professional capabilities, capacities. In the Air Force, John served as a commissioned officer for 24 years as a pilot. With his wealth of knowledge, John became a business consultant with 27 businesses. John was elected and reelected as state representative for the 33rd District of Tennessee. He focused his efforts on education, illegal immigration, and the economy. John is a Southern Baptist, a pro-life advocate, father of two, and grandfather of three. John has been working to improve Tennessee schools from day one, General Assembly. With John in office, teacher salaries have increased with every budget, and our K through 12 schools have set records for improvement of national standards testing. However, there is still lots of room for improvement, and John is continuing to push for even more progress. Thanks to his and other Republicans' efforts in Nashville, Tennessee is the first state in the union to offer adult access to community and technical colleges free of tuition and fees. Representative Reagan, thank you so much for being on the Mill Creek View podcast with me today. How are you? Did you know the Oak Ridge boys are from the 40s from your town?
Yes, I'm doing fine. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Although the Oak Ridge boys were actually from Knoxville, they took their name as they did because they performed here. And this was where they decided that their career started from. But you're right. They were made famous here and have made a lot of wonderful songs. Some of which I appreciate, some of which I have some problems with.
Well, first off, please tell our listeners a little about Oak Ridge in Anderson County and the demographics of your District 33 voter. And congratulations, UT, right next to you, for beating Alabama for the first time in 15 years. 52 points scored by Tennessee were the most against Alabama in any game since 1907. Lots of trivia today. Great, great season so far.
Well, yes, thank you. As far as my district is concerned, I'm a little long in the tooth in the General Assembly. That is to say that I have been through two redistrictings there now, and the county, Anderson County, which is most of District 33, or I should say District 33 is most of the county. When I first began representing it, though, it was a lot more. As the population has increased, while the number of voters I represent remains the same, the geographic area has gotten much smaller. The demographics are, well, difficult to explain in some respects. We are a typical East Tennessee county, which is to say, while Tennessee as a state has about the same black population or Hispanic population as any other state, it's distributed a little differently. East Tennessee is a little lower in percentage-wise than the black population, about the same in the Hispanic, but it's a unique district in a lot of ways. As you mentioned, we have a long history here. The city was originally called the Secret City because, in fact, while it was the fifth largest city in Tennessee, it showed on no maps in 1943 when it was literally raised out of the mud for the Manhattan Project. It is a very unique town in that respect. A great many of the population that were here in that time frame left after World War II was won, although they soon realized immediately afterwards when the Soviet Union detonated their first atomic bomb and the Cold War was on that the city would have to continue doing what it started doing in the Manhattan era. And in fact, we still are today. We have the Y-12 National Security Complex here in the city of Oak Ridge. That Y-12 National Security Complex still manufactures a lot of the kinds of things it did for World War II efforts in the atomic bomb there, although today's weapons are far more sophisticated and far more deadly. In addition to the Y-12 complex, there's also the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which is world famous and, in fact, is the largest and first of the national laboratories. I think there's up to 17 now, but it still leads the world in its discoveries and capacities. In fact, just a few short years ago, a new element was put on the atomic element chart named Tennessine. And of course, named after the University of Tennessee in our state. In addition to that, it has the world's fastest computer, a title that keeps going back and forth, but I think it's probably going to remain here for a while because they're into quantum computing now. And for your podcast listeners and viewers, that's a unique threshold. Quantum mechanics is one of those things that is, shall we say, counterintuitive until you've studied it for quite a while. But building a computer on that basis not only makes it the fastest in the world, it also makes it the highest capacity. And in fact, a lot of the work that was done on COVID-19 virus properties was sequenced through this massive computer that we have here. In addition to that, it leads the world in material research. That is to say, making things out of carbon fiber more cheaply than is possible other places, and printing things with 3D printing. Some of your podcast viewers may be familiar with a car that was driven by our former governor, Bill Haslam, the one before the most current one, to the Chicago Auto Show. It was a 3D printed Shelby Cobra, an amazing thing.
Wow.
Additionally, the Army called up a few years back and said they had equipment that they couldn't get parts for because some of it was sold to manufacturers were no longer in business. They wanted to know if the lab could make 3D printed parts for them. They said, well, I don't know. So they decided to print an old World War II Jeep to see. And sure enough, we have a 3D printed World War II Jeep sitting around.
That's unbelievable.
An amazing place to be.
It is. It's a vital part of the country, and you are blessed. We are blessed to have you representing it. And you're running in a campaign that's in a few weeks from now. And we are, thank you for taking time out for the campaign trail to talk to us. You're running against Democrat Jim Dodson with, like I said, a few days away from now. This is your sixth, I believe, campaign for Congress, isn't it?
Oh, actually, I'm running for my seventh, and it's not Congress,
seventh.
It's General Assembly.
General Assembly, right. And last time in 2018, you beat Richard Dawson, not the same guy and not the Family Feud host. And you got 61 to 38%. So congratulations there. How's your campaign looking at the end here?
Well, this campaign is a lot more challenging. Jim Dodson, who, by the way, is a nice guy. I'm not going to say bad things about him. Our positions are certainly at polar opposites. So this election will be about positions. But the campaign itself is kicking into high gear. We've been out, knocking on doors and going to various town hall events and so forth, meeting with the constituents. In fact, just Saturday, I was at something called the October Sky Festival, named after the movie, as a matter of fact. For again, your podcast viewers that are familiar, that movie was about a rocket scientist in West Virginia who went on to become a NASA engineer. The rocket scientist, though, was a teenager when the movie was made. I won't go into the plot. It's an entertaining movie. However, a great portion of it was actually filmed here in the little town of Oliver Springs in my district. So every October, they have an October Sky Festival. And, of course, all of us politicians go out there and put up our tents and sit around and talk to our constituents and answer their questions to get their inputs, as well as lots and lots of music. You mentioned the Oak Ridge Boys earlier. We had the modern day equivalents there this go around. The weather was great this time too. Fabulous. And some of the best Southern cooking you can find. It's amazing what people put up there.
I'll put that on my list of things to do next year for sure. You graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy, and I read the military is having a terrible time meeting their recruitment quotas, down 25% in most branches, which is a tragedy. What do you make of the reason for that, and how do you feel about the current state of readiness in our armed forces?
Well, of course, I have been retired for quite a while now. You can see from my lapel here that I did quite a bit while I was in the military for 24 years. Most of my time was in fighter cockpits, although I did a tour as a forward air controller with the 82nd Airborne. Traumatic experience jumping out of airplanes that are still flying. But anyway, directly to your question, our recruiting problem, in my humble opinion, is a function of what the military has been ordered to do by our civilian masters. That is create wokeness. I personally disagree with that in the sense that people are losing sight of the fact that the military exists, if you'll pardon the crudity of the expression, to kill people and break things and to make sure that they don't come over here and kill our people and break our things. The underlying mission of the military is to win wars. It is not to take care of these woke agendas and shall we say, be involved in social engineering. And many of our young people are looking at that and saying, you know, they're asking me as a volunteer for this duty to put my life on the line, to be willing to die or to kill in the service of my country. And at the same time, they're not showing the gratitude and support that this mission requires. And so they're just not joining. Now, that's a personal opinion, and I must hasten to add my personal opinion, not that of anybody that is in a position of authority other than where I sit.
Yeah, and I know you're a Tennessee State Assemblyman, not U.S. Congress, but what are your thoughts on the Commander-in-Chief and his Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, and Secretary of Defense Austin? Are they doing a good job or are they doing a bad job?
Well, the current Commander-in-Chief, in my humble opinion, is not doing a good job, politically or otherwise. The Chief of Staff, General Milley, and his staff members have sworn an oath to support the Constitution, and they're governed by something called the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That Code of Military Justice prevents them from being critical of their political taskmasters, the civilian leadership, if you will, while they're in uniform. And so if they're doing their job properly, they salute smartly and do as the Commander-in-Chief has ordered them to do. So with that said, I'm going to be a little circumspect in offering any criticism of those people. I myself, in the latter part of my career, when I had a little more rank, had some opinions about political goings on that I had to keep to myself because it was my sworn duty to do so.
Fair enough. I sure would like to see some of the money headed to Ukraine go to our states like Florida for Ian cleanup or Missouri drinking water, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Again, though, you must remember that the federal budget is huge. The fact that we have a $31 trillion debt in that's being serviced by that budget should tell you how much money is being spent. Only about 25% of the budget approaches anything called discretionary spending. That is to say, 75% of it is obligated even before Congress meets to pass the appropriations bills, things like Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera, are eating up our money before it actually gets to the point where they start allocating it. The military budget, while it is huge, and it is a very large expenditure, as a percentage of the total federal spending is actually pretty small. Now, again, the total numbers we're talking about are huge. So that when I say pretty small, I must remember I'm talking percentages. And that small percentage still is a lot of money. It buys multi-million dollar jets and tanks and ships, as well as paying the salaries of all of the people we have in uniform. So it's a lot of money anyway you slice it. But in terms of allocating it to other sources or other, pardon me, other competing priorities, like disaster cleanup in Florida, for example, certainly we could do some of that. And we could, in fact, reprioritize some of the other spending into that area as well. But that's a federal issue, and I deal more in the state issues.
Yeah, I just wanted your opinion. So back to you. Right after this interview, you and your opponent, Jim Dobson, are invited tonight to discuss LGBTQ issues with the PFLAG group that meets with First Presbyterian, First United Methodist, Oak Ridge Unitarian, Universalist Churches, and the Jewish Congregation of Oak Ridge, PFLAG, formerly an acronym for Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, is the United States' largest organization uniting families and allies with people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer, they say. Its mission is to provide opportunities for dialogue about sexual orientation and gender identities and to create a society that is healthy and respectful of human diversity. How do you think that will go? Are you actually attending that?
No, actually, I'm not attending that. My official duties call for me to be in Nashville tomorrow. As you read in my biography there, I chair the Government Operations Committee, which is meeting tomorrow. We are, in fact, conducting a rule review for a number of our agencies that are in state government. So I will not be able to prepare for my duties in that committee and do this debate this evening at the same time. I raised my hand and swore a duty, and I intend to carry it out. Getting reelected is important to me, but executing the duties I've already sworn to do are more important.
Okay. I kind of assumed that it would be topical because of what's going on recently. And I'd like to talk to you about Vanderbilt Medical in the wake of the Daily Wire's Matt Walsh exposing the goings on there. I believe it was 2018, correct me if I'm wrong, when you and State Senator Janice Bowling introduced HB 578 and her Senate Bill 675 and HB 2835 and SB 2696, which is the Youth Health Protection Act, which would have prevented sexual identity change therapy to prepubescent minors, prohibit identity change therapy surgery to minors without parental consent, and punish violations as child abuse and designated violations by healthcare professionals as professional misconduct. It got through two House committees and died in the Senate. The majority leader of the Senate is Jack Johnson. Why do you think the Senate didn't pass this bill back then and instead sprung into action now?
Well, again, second guessing the other chamber is something I've learned to do with a great deal of caution. I have a lot of friends in the Senate chamber, but by the same token, I gave up trying to figure out sometimes what they were doing and the reasons they were doing it. As far as getting it through the House, yes, you're correct. We got it through. It's rare to have bills, what we call double referred. That only happens when there are overlying jurisdictions. In the case of the bill you mentioned, it went first to the Judiciary Committee because I had written in a criminal penalty into it, and then it went to the Health Committee. Actually got it all the way up to the end of the Health Committee, ready to put it on calendar and rules, when my Senate co-sponsor, Senator Bowling, informed me that the Senate was not going to push it through. At that particular time, as a speculation, I would say that they were concerned, if that's the right word, that the bill might be a little overly broad. I didn't see it that way, obviously, since I was one of the primary authors of it, but I respect their opinion. I have, in fact, drafted another bill, which if I'm reelected, I will file immediately after the election, and have another run at that. In fact, I think several of my colleagues are now going to join me both in the House and the Senate in that. And after we get through thrashing around exactly what kind of language we want in the bill, I may actually wind up being a co-sponsor with a number of other people.
That's great. Excuse me. After the exposure, the Vanderbilt Pediatric Gender Clinic has agreed to pause all gender transition surgeries on minors under 18 while they review. So the bill that you're going to bring back, not an emergency session, but actually in the next session, like you said, if you win, hopefully that turns out to be a permanent ban. Governor Lee said we should not allow permanent life-altering decisions that hurt children. With the partnership of the General Assembly, this practice should end in Tennessee. He said that on October 8th. And Jack Johnson, again, Senate Majority Leader, where your bill died in the Senate, said whether it's mutilating surgery, which I would submit that it does violate the federal law, or if it's administering drugs to delay the onset of puberty is a violation of laws that we've already passed. And we do have our folks looking into that to see if, in fact, Vanderbilt has not already violated either federal or state law. Why didn't those two push that in 18?
Well, again, you're asking me to speak for someone else, and I'm reluctant to do that. Suffice it to say that that issue, which Senator Bowling and I were in complete agreement on and had done a lot of research on. In fact, if you go back, our committee sessions are online. They're archived, so they, you can actually go back and see the various testimonies that were made in those bills. It's very clear, I think, to someone who is open-minded that asking young children to make life-altering decisions that will permanently affect them for the remainder of their lives is rather foolish. We don't let children get driver's license until they're 16, and even then only with parental consent. Otherwise, it's 18. We don't let them enlist in the military until they're 17, and again, only with parental consent. We don't allow them to be married until age 18. So there's a lot of things that we realize that require judgment for permanent life-altering decisions, and or even those that maybe that way, that we do not allow children to do. And yet we have people who are advocating that these young children who we do not allow to drink, drive, join the military, and any number of other things, are competent to make a decision to undergo hormone therapy, which frequently, and most of the time I'm told, does result in permanent sterilization. And beyond that, surgeries that are disfiguring, as well as sterilization. Yet these people maintain that these children, minors, have the judgment at that age to make that kind of decision.
It's irreversible, and we don't even know if the drugs cause cancer or what the long-term effects are. And Vanderbilt, who should know better, they noted that the clinic had relied on, quote, leading medical specialty societies such as the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, WPATH, and the Endocrine Society. In September, that WPATH dropped age limits for surgeries in teenagers, any age. Not exactly leading medical specialty. How strong is WPATH, and can they overrule Tennessee?
Well, the answer to your question, second question, is no, they cannot. States have the authority to set medical practice standards within their boundaries. And regardless of what the organization is, they can't overrule state law. The only thing they can do is sue to say that state law is in conflict with federal law. And in this case, the feds would have to back off and say, no, that's a state function. It's clearly within the bounds established in our Constitution for the states to determine.
Vanderbilt also said that they do about five a year. So that's 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Five times five is 25 victims, let's call them. Have any approached you or your colleagues with regrets or wanting to sue?
Well, first off, I doubt they would approach us for wanting to sue. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't play one on television. Mm-hmm. Having said that, though, they would most likely go to a private attorney for suits. Now, as far as approaching us is concerned, the answer to your question is I get hundreds of emails per day all over the state, not just my district, of course, about a variety of topics, but no small number about this one. And quite frankly, I get them on both sides of the issue. Although I have to say that as of this point in time, it appears that the overwhelming majority of Tennesseans are not in favor of transgender surgeries or hormone therapy. Of course, you know, there are groups that try to take what I call a push poll and say, well, we polled the people and they say this and that. But the reality is, once upon a time in my checkered career after I retired from the Air Force, I was the equivalent of a professional statistician and was involved in that kind of activity. So I understand that polls are things that must be done carefully, and you must abide by a very stringent set of criteria to get a valid result. And if you choose, which some do, unfortunately, you can make a poll say almost anything you want it to.
Sure.
And frequently they do.
I mean, to be honest with you, I think it has a lot to do with informed consent, parental rights, and taxpayer-funded things like what was Roe versus Wade and whether the federal government should pay for abortions or now transgender surgery. And if somebody is a parent and they say that their child can do this, I guess that could be legal. But if they're going to say it's going to be Medicare, it's going to be state funds, it's going to be a university that gets public funds, probably shouldn't happen. Now, Tennessee Attorney General Jonathan Scarametti said his office also confirmed an investigation. He said, we are aware of allegations of illegal conduct at the Clinic for Transgender Health at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. General Scarametti will use the full scope of his authority to ensure compliance with Tennessee law, he said. Could VUMC be shut down as a criminal organization over this?
It would be difficult, but the answer technically is yes, they could be. I doubt that would happen because Vanderbilt has a lot of smart people there, and they would find out exactly where that legal line is and walk right up to the edge and not cross it if they could. Or if they did, it would be by accident. That said, there are a lot of people who push this to the limits, and they will push it as far as they can. Tennessee does have a law on the books against female genital mutilation. That law was passed some time ago, and it was aimed primarily at the cultural practice of some Middle Eastern cultures who were immigrants to this country of genital mutilation of young females. And again, surgeries that do that are violating that law. That's our state law. Now, Vanderbilt maintains that they don't do the surgeries on children that young. That seems to me to be a questionable assertion, given that they've said they've treated these people. If they're doing hormone treatments, that's a little different. But in reality, hormone treatments can be called chemical castration. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, they result in sterility for a great many, if not most or all of their recipients.
Now, the ACLU of Tennessee launched a transgender education initiative called Transcend Tennessee, has condemned calls for an investigation into Vanderbilt University Medical Center and attempts to limit transgender health care, they call it. Are they going to be able to stop us?
No. Again, straightforwardly, the state government is bound only by state law. Now, of course, courts can interpret that law. We in the legislature write it. And when we write it, we try to put it as clear as we can, our intent. And courts are bound both by tradition and their own rules to try to follow the intent of the legislative construction of a law. These organizations that try to stop that would only be able to take it to court and perhaps get a temporary injunction, but I doubt that even.
Again, yeah, I mean, the same organization is also fighting Arkansas's first in the nation law called Save Adolescents from Experimentation, SAFE. Act, saying the surgery is medically necessary for youth gender dysphoria. Might Tennessee join Alabama and Arizona and I guess Iowa and Missouri as well on their own versions? If the ACLU wins, all states in the Eighth Circuit would be helpless to stop it. It's bad when judges decide everything, isn't it?
Well, again, I'm very circumspect about criticizing fellow members of the government, especially those who might pay best in judgment on the bills that I write. That said, judges are limited. Our Constitution has three co-equal branches, and those branches are structured to balance power. And we would, in fact, as a legislature, take whatever action we thought we needed to stop that. We have the power in the General Assembly to remove state judges. We don't have to impeach them. We can remove them. And in fact, that was in consideration several sessions ago. It's rare that it even comes into consideration, because most of the judges come before us after they're nominated for confirmation. And during that confirmation process, we try to satisfy ourselves that the judges are going to stay within the constraints of the Constitution, which, of course, we try to stay within ourselves. To this specific issue, though, transgenderism and the so-called dysphoria, body dysphoria, if one looks at that very, very thoughtfully, what it boils down to is someone is unhappy. That's what the term dysphoria means, to be greatly unhappy with their body. They're trying to deny reality. The reality is each and every human being has an XX or XY chromosome in every cell of their body that's not devoted to human reproduction. So that, of course, you know, people watch these crime shows and they see DNA results presented. And of course, it doesn't happen nearly as quickly as it does on television. But the fact of the matter is, you can tell an individual's sex from any cell of their body. And to say that, well, I was born in the wrong body, is to make an accusation that is not reality. The reality
is a mental health issue for sure.
Concept that's different than what it should be.
That's right. And you know, Vanderbilt is on video talking about big money for top and bottom surgery and a lifetime of medical billing and streaming income in the transition and drugs. Will going without these services economically devastate Vanderbilt?
Not at all. No. Vanderbilt, like many of our Ivy League institutions, has endowments such that it doesn't need to worry about income of any sort.
Right. So it's just for money. They also said out loud, if anyone working there had conscientious objections to providing this care, they weren't welcome. Isn't that a civil rights violation of those that object? And are there whistleblowers with more revelations to come?
The answer to your question is, I suspect there are whistleblowers that will come forward with more. That said, Vanderbilt is a private entity, but they are bound by national and state civil rights laws. That means that they have to adhere to those. So yes, you're correct. The prohibition, in fact, our state mirrors the federal law in that we have established that religion is a protected class. That is to say, someone cannot be forced to perform acts or say things that violate deeply held religious beliefs. And if they're holding employment as a lever or a Damocles sword over the employee's head, if you will, and forcing them to violate their deeply held religious beliefs, in my opinion, they are violating civil rights laws. And in fact, there's cases that have gone to the Supreme Court over that. Most recently, there was one that clouded the waters a little bit, and that was called Bostock versus Clay County, in which the Supreme Court ruled that an employment law, which is under Title VII of the U.S. Code, there were some very narrow employment law requirements for employers to observe concerning transgender behavior and so forth, dress primarily. But nonetheless, forcing someone to do something that violates their deeply held religious beliefs is enshrined, quite frankly, in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and in our own Tennessee state constitution.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned that Vanderbilt is a private institution, so I guess that there are some differences for them, not certainly not federal or state law, but some differences. But is this a problem at UT Medical Center too, and I guess all university med centers?
Well, it could potentially be so. UT Medical Center, though, is partially state funded, and therefore it is very directly and deeply entwined with ensuring that it follows our state human rights laws and civil rights laws. Like I said, there's some leeway for private institutions that would not be there for our state-supported institutions.
Do you think we might hear news out of there as well, or is it contained at Vanderbilt for now?
I hesitate to say what's going on in some other institutions that I don't know about.
Okay.
That said, I don't think that they're performing these things.
Okay, good. Well, now let's talk about CRT, or what it's called in Tennessee, Wit and Wisdom. House Speaker Cameron Sexton introduced House Bill 2670 back in February. The General Assembly passed it, and Governor Lee signed it into law in April. It targets divisive concepts, quote unquote, preventing teachers in Tennessee from bringing up certain ideas in the classroom. The complaints that I received from parents were that their children were being indoctrinated rather than educated. Reagan said education is teaching children how to think, not what to think. Several professors argued the bill has a chilling effect on the way educators do their jobs. I maintain just the opposite. The bill, while it has prohibitive concepts, it's prohibiting advocacy, not discussion, Reagan said. In fact, the part of the bill specifically says that these kinds of bills are open for discussion as long as they're not advocated. Professors at faculty at universities and colleges are specially qualified to teach the classes that they teach. They need to be in charge of what does. Oh, I should have clarified this. This is what the UT Knoxville professor Christina Gehrman said in reply to what you said. Professors at faculty at university and colleges are especially qualified to teach the classes that they teach. They need to be in charge of what goes on in their classrooms. And when the legislature comes in and starts dictating what can and cannot be discussed, that disrupts the entire purpose of higher education. You disagree with Professor Gehrman, right?
Well, I disagree with her assertion. And let's start off with saying I myself have been adjunct faculty at two different universities, both at Embry-Riddle and the University of Tennessee. So the assertion that college professors are somehow demigods who are able to walk on water when it's not frozen is a bit of an exaggeration. Beyond all that, the professor is teaching at a public institution. That is to say, taxpayer supported. We, the citizens of Tennessee, own that. The buildings, the property, et cetera, belongs to us. We hire those people to do a job for us. Now, that job, of course, requires a great deal of expertise, and I certainly will not object to professors asserting that they have that specific expertise. Like I said, I've been there, and the reason I was adjunct faculty is because I had some knowledge and experience that my students didn't have that I was imparting to them. That said, when you get outside of a philosophy class, or a similar type of instruction arena, opinions are just that. Now, they may be well-informed opinions, but they're still opinions. And the population that pays the bills, i.e. the average Tennessean, still has a say in it. Now, to directly address the issue that she brought up, what is discussed, the prohibited concepts bill, by the way, which was, I was the original author of that bill, and I aimed my first effort at the K-12 education system in our state. The bill you mentioned by Speaker Sexton took that concept and went all the way into the collegiate arena. And you are exactly correct. It is intended not to chill discussion or inquiry or debate, but to rather prohibit advocacy by a professor. Professors / college instructors, whatever term you want to put on that, are in a unique position before their students. They are recognized as experts, and therefore what they say carries a great deal more influence and impact with their students than just, Joe Bag of Donuts walking in off the street. And it should. But that said, when professors are advocating political concepts, philosophical concepts, they're kind of crossing a line there. There's certainly nothing wrong with them challenging students to think for themselves. That is part of what the college experience is about. That is not what this law is intended to prohibit. It's intended to prohibit someone who would create little Marxists or the equivalent thereof, in a college classroom.
All right. Let's see. With the ACT scores that just got released showing results down about 40% and one out of three kids not reading at grade level in Tennessee, I wish the schools would focus on reading and writing instead of this nonsense. You've been outspoken about the strings attached and weaponization of Title IX, haven't you? Actually calling out 11 state universities, challenging them for publishing false statements that implied that LGBTQ plus students are a protected class under Title IX. What do you mean by that?
Well, very briefly, a little history here. Title IX came into being in the early 1970s, and it was intended to balance, if you will, rights of the women in college, is primarily against what they felt was an unfair balance toward men. Specifically in the sports arena, which was more visible. Now, it applies in other areas as well. But the end result was that there was a lot of women's sports that suddenly gained a lot of support financially in other ways, and perhaps they should have. I'm certainly not going to say they shouldn't. But the intent was to make it even or balanced for women. Now, Title IX has existed since then. After the initial hoopla and shall we say, heat and light that was creating a lot of disturbance, it settled into what it was for the next 40 years. Women's sports did indeed achieve as much parity as possible under Title IX. And in fact, here at the University of Tennessee, we had some outstanding women's teams. I think if I remember correctly, Coach Pat Head Summit is still the winningest basketball coach, either male or female, in our nation's history. And of course, the Lady Vols, as they were called, were national champions a number of times. So women's sports was a very important thing. Now, the problem that has arisen is that at the national level, the U.S. Department of Education, beginning back in the Obama administration, tried to rewrite the Title IX law by saying that, well, sex doesn't mean what it meant in 1972. Where it was clearly understood to be a biological discriminator. It is either male or female.
That's exactly right. I have a letter here from James Lane at the U.S. Department of Education to Commissioner of Education Penny Schwinn, demanding implementation of assessment and accountability requirements to all Tennessee students. And if TDOE fails to meet these requirements, the department may take additional enforcement action, which could mean Tennessee requires to give back a lot of money. What do you make of the federal department making demands on Tennessee schools like that?
In the first place, I'll be very blunt. It's the equivalent of extortion. They do not have the legal authority to tell the states to do this. Of course, I've ruled very, very straightforwardly that's the case. So what they do is they say, we give you money, but we will withhold the money if you don't do what we want you to. That's the lever that they use to try to get their enforcement mechanism in place. And in fact, most of our colleges and universities have become so dependent on federal money that threat is a very real threat of bankruptcy. Federal grants for research, Pell grants for student loans, and a number of other sources of federal money is enough to make a college or a university staff literally quake in their boots at the thought of losing it, because quite honestly, it would spell financial disaster for that institution. So that's the lever they use. However, the courts have ruled in the case of other situations that administrative agencies cannot rewrite law. And in fact, a judge here in East Tennessee has put an injunction on the U.S. Department of Education that was applicable to Tennessee and then the 19 other states that sued with us. We were the lead state in that suit, the Dobbs case, to say that the U.S. Department of Education doesn't have that authority. So that letter you're referring to has no impact until the Supreme Court rules otherwise.
That's great. Well, you have been very generous with your time. I just have time for maybe one or two more questions. Thank you so much again for coming on with us. I'm here with Rep. Reagan from Anderson County. What do you think about a drag queen Christmas this year, thanks to the Tennessee Performing Arts Center, but Nashvillians don't get their annual Christmas parade? Says a lot about our times, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. It is a social comment that I am very sad to see personally. It's amazing to me at the skewed value system that that kind of situation displays.
Yeah. And I have a grave concern myself with the indentured servitude language and how that could be used as a more jail reform or more jail reform by letting even more prisoners unwilling to work out let them out early under the legal complaint that they are slaves if they must work for a paycheck. Do you think I could be right on that? And how would you recommend voters vote on the four constitutional amendments on the ballot next month?
Well, let me address that one specifically. That's amendment number 3 on the ballot.
Right.
That is aimed, quite frankly, at a sentence that is given in a number of states to include our own Uniform Code of Military Justice. One can be sentenced to confinement at hard labor. That is the definition of slavery. Our own U.S. Constitution allows that sentence, as does our state constitution currently. There's a movement afoot to say that, well, slavery shouldn't be allowed even as part of a sentence for a crime. Now, I'm going to, rather than recommend voters vote a certain way on that, I'm going to say to the voters that are voting on that, make your best guess on that one and vote your conscience. I personally do not think that that sentence to hard labor is in fact unjust in some cases, but that's a very personal opinion. And I want those who are voting on this to come to their own personal opinions as well, after having looked at the amendment very carefully. The other amendments, amendment number 1 is a good one. I support that one, encourage others to. Essentially what we're doing is clarifying the succession plan for our governor should something happen. Right now, if the governor is killed and or permanently disabled, and it's obvious that he will not be able to continue his duties, the lieutenant governor steps into his place. The lieutenant governor is the Speaker of the Senate, Randy McNally. However, beyond that, we have no succession. So this amendment allows for the Speaker of the House to be next in line, just like it does in our federal government. And it also allows for a governor to be temporarily removed from office for some sort of medical condition, perhaps a stroke or something such as that, until they are competent to return. That's something we probably should have foreseen when the Constitution was originally constructed. And let's see, the other amendments out there are less controversial. Since we're running short on time, I won't dwell on those. But again, I encourage everyone to read those. And with the exception of number 3, I'm personally going to support them. Number 3 is a very personal decision for each voter to make.
I agree. Okay. Well, we are at the end of our time with you. Thank you very much. But be sure to let everyone know how they can follow your campaign, donate money, help if you can. Tell us where they can find you online.
Okay. Reagan, R-A-G-A-N. The number 4, tn.com is my website. And if they want to contribute to my campaign, it's certainly welcome. Mm-hmm. Because quite honestly, campaigning costs a lot of money. I never held a political office before my current one. And I was shocked at how much money it took to buy radio, TV, and newspaper ads just to tell people what you stood for. If they want to contribute, I would suggest a check to 119 Morningside Drive, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Committee to Elect Reagan. I've disabled my online contribution mechanism, frankly, because of some hacking that has taken place in other campaign contributions. A check would be better if it's at all possible.
Okay, that is good to know. And thanks again for coming on with us, and good luck.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Pleasure.
This pawn shop ticket for this week's rent. Well, last week's check
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard and anything else on my mind. Steve, sometimes we have entertainers and sometimes we have politicians on. What did you make of Rep. Reagan's politics?
Well, I learned a lot about where he lives and about the laboratory and all the security complex and all that. That was very interesting. And once you got into the meat and potatoes aspect of the interview, I was very glad to hear that he is not for the woke movement, the CRT movement, and that he is working hard to try to stem the tide that's going on there. And yet he's also letting everybody know that he's one voice. He has to work within a system that's built into our legislation in the Senate, and that he's doing the best he can, and that if he gets back in there, they're going to come back and do it again to try to get rid of this LGBT movement and this. So I learned a lot, Steve.
Yeah. And I just wish that the 25 or so victims hadn't had to go through what they went through, but we'll try to prevent it from ever happening again. And I wanted to read a headline to everybody. Jury decides conspiracy theorist Alex Jones should pay nearly $1 billion in damages to Sandy Hook families for his lies about the school massacre. Now, I honestly don't know very much about Alex Jones. I don't listen to him. I don't really care about him, but I truly do care about truth and lies and freedom of speech. Why don't you play that clip?
Okay.
Actually, before you do, I want to read what the plaintiff's lawyer said after they won. His name is Christopher Mattei. An attorney for the plaintiffs had urged jurors to award at least $500 million for having permanently mangled the lives of his clients. The figure, he said, would represent the more than 550 million online impressions Jones's Sandy Hook lie allegedly received online. Quote, "You may say this is astronomical. It is," Mattei said. "It's exactly what Alex Jones set himself up to do. That's what he built. He built a lie machine that could push this stuff out. You reap what you sow." Play the clip, please.
"You're okay. You're not going to get COVID if you have these vaccinations.
Vaccines prevent getting infected, prevent getting sick, prevent your hospitalization.
Our data from the CDC today suggests, that vaccinated people do not carry the virus, don't get sick, and that it's not just in the clinical trials, but it's also in real world data.
Now we know that the vaccines work well enough that the virus stops with every vaccinated person. A vaccinated person gets exposed to the virus. The virus does not infect them. The virus cannot then use that person to go anywhere else."
Okay. That was Joe, Tony, Rochelle Walensky, and of course, Rachel Maddow. The lawyer said as well, "The jury verdict is a testament to that courage in a resounding affirmation that people of goodwill, dedicated to the truth, mindful of their responsibilities to their fellow citizens, can come together to protect the innocent, to reveal lies masquerading as truth, and to set right a historic wrong," Mattei told reporters. Producer Steve, what do you think?
Well, let's back up here for a moment. I'm a little more familiar with the Sandy Hook situation. Done a little investigating. I'm not going to mention my opinion on that. But let's say this. He had nothing to do with Sandy Hook. He was an investigator. He examined the evidence that, from his standpoint, said, this is a false flag event, that yes, something happened, but we don't have as much proof as they're saying. And he didn't do, so let's just say that everybody was killed, according to the everybody saying, officials report.
I think my point, Steve, is more that people who took the vaccine
may be able to get
$1 billion or more per announcement from those clips that we just played.
Well, no, I was trying to mention that he didn't do anything to harm anybody. The harm had already been done, whether he is right or wrong. The fact is, what they're telling us, everything in that clip, they lied to us, and the harm of tens of thousands, if not hundreds, if not millions of people from that jab, that vaccine, and they lied. And are they going to get put in, are they going to get sued? That's what you're asking, and that's exactly right. Why aren't they getting put in the court?
Right. If we want to punish lies, we really do. Let's get on it. Because whatever punishment the system thinks Jones deserves, the likes of Fauci, your groomer teacher, and the child mutilators at your local gender clinic deserve far worse by a factor of eternity in hell. But yes. Stay tuned for my thought of the week.
I don't understand how you ever did without me. I don't understand how I bring you down to your knees.
Welcome to our Thought of the Week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to the Mill Creek View podcast. Just go to Podomatic, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Democracy extends the sphere of individual freedoms. Socialism restricts it. Democracy attaches all possible value to each man. Socialism makes each man a mere agent, a mere number. Democrats and socialism have nothing in common but one word, equality. But notice the difference. While democracy seeks equality in liberty, socialism seeks equality in restraint and servitude. Alexis de Tocqueville. Definitely read some books about that guy. Well, that's it for this episode. I want to thank our guest, Representative Reagan, and thank you for listening to the Mill Creek View podcast. Until our next show, this is Steve Abramowitz, Managing Director of Mill Creek Financial Partners, signing off. I'll be back tomorrow with another lover of truth and the Lord. Don't miss it. And as always, peace in our time.
Children and the pumpkins at the county fair. They were looking for America behind every